From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Nearly 1 in 5 high school students reported using e-cigarettes last year. That's almost 20% of high school students. The FDA has gone as far as calling teen vaping an epidemic. Now, vape's sleek design, fruity flavors, and large doses of nicotine can be addictive, but there's little research on how to best treat vaping habits among teens. So now cities and states around the country are trying to clamp down on vaping by raising the minimum purchasing age for tobacco products from 18 to 21. Will it work? And what did an entire generation's worth of anti-tobacco campaigns teach us about effective ways to change teen behavior? This hour on Point, Tobacco 21 and teen vaping. And you can join us. Are you a teenager who's tried e-cigarettes? Are you a worried parent? What is your story? Will raising the e-cigarette age to 21 make any difference? And what do you think it will take to curb teen vaping? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Now, Illinois just recently raised its tobacco age to 21. So let's listen for a moment to Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, who signed the legislation on Sunday. Here he is announcing the rule change.
This is about the health of our youth and the longevity of our citizens. And if there are young people who will travel over state lines to buy tobacco products because they can legally buy them there, then I urge the surrounding states to pass Tobacco 21 too.
It's Illinois' Governor J.B. Pritzker on Sunday. Joining us now from Chicago is Dr. Julie Morita, Commissioner for the City of Chicago's Department of Public Health. And under her leadership, Chicago raised the age for purchasing cigarettes and e-cigarettes, tobacco products in general, to 21 back in 2016. And as you just heard, the entire state of Illinois followed suit this past weekend. Dr. Morita, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for hosting us.
So first of all, tell us a little bit about what you saw in terms of changes in teen vaping rates in Chicago over the past couple of years that prompted you to change the purchasing age back in 2016.
So I think our approach for tobacco started before vaping even came onto the scene. We recognized that the best way to prevent problems with tobacco-related disease was really trying to prevent young people from smoking. And so we implemented a number of different things starting from 2013. However, when we did start seeing that e-cigarettes and vaping was becoming a problem, we really did escalate our efforts. And so we could see that the trend was rising rapidly, that more and more young people were experimenting with e-cigarettes and vaping, and that the rise was really rapid. That helped us really motivate others to move forward with instituting Tobacco 21 in 2016.
Yeah. So can I just jump in here? Because some of the numbers around tobacco usage in teens in Chicago is quite remarkable. I mean, I see that you've written that that Chicago has reduced cigarette smoking rates by high school students from a little over 13%, which it was in 2011, down to 6% today. Do you attribute that to raising the purchase age to 21?
So I think we know about tobacco use among youth is that if we make these products less affordable, less accessible, and less attractive to youth, they will be much less likely to purchase these products. And so in 2013, we created a flavored tobacco ban around schools so that schools couldn't sell mint flavor or candy flavored tobacco products within 500 feet of high schools. We also increased the price of regular cigarettes by increasing the taxes. And then in 2014, we made e-cigarettes part of our Clean Indoor Act ordinance, which prevents young people from smoking around or inside of buildings. But then we also included e-cigarettes in that ban. Those kinds of efforts, along with Tobacco 21, have contributed to the major reduction that we saw in young people smoking cigarettes. But that's what we have. We have a reduction of high school students smoking cigarettes that doesn't necessarily reflect their activity as it relates to vaping or juuling.
Right, because you say here in a piece that you wrote that e-cigarette use by teens is in Chicago is at 6.6%, so higher now than cigarette use.
Well, that was in 2017, and at that time, our percentage of kids smoking, high school students smoking cigarettes was 6%, and those that reported or admitted to vaping or using e-cigarettes was 6.6%. I know or suspect that the rates of young people using e-cigarettes and vaping is probably higher than that right now because it was just a massive explosion of use. The manufacturers were unbelievably successful in marketing their products to young people. And as a result, we see many, many young people that are using these products and actually addicted.
Actually addicted. Okay, so we're going to talk a little later in the show about exactly what's in these e-cigarettes and why maybe teenage brains are more susceptible to addiction through them. But what have you heard from parents, from teachers around Chicago about how much more or if they are seeing more e-cigarette usage amongst teens?
So I am a parent in addition to being a public health official and a pediatrician, and I have a 16-year-old who's in high school in a Chicago public school. And so I talked to his peers and his peers' parents and the teachers in his school, and I know that the juuling and the vaping is a major problem. It's not just limited to my son's school. When I talk to parents of kids that age in high school or even in middle school, across the board, they are concerned about their children being exposed to vaping, taking on the habit of juuling, and the potential the health hazards that that really poses.
Mm. So I guess I heard you say a little earlier, Dr. Morita, that not only did you raise the purchasing age to 21 in Chicago, or the city of Chicago did that, but there were all these other efforts as well about banning places where cigarettes or even e-cigarettes could be used. But now I'm also wondering, given what you just said about the powerful marketing of vaping, and you know, companies like Juul will say that they do not intentionally market to minors or teens. I want to acknowledge that. That's what Juul would say. But does more need to be done beyond the raising of the purchasing age?
Definitely. And so I think, again, we increase the age of purchasing. We also prohibit the use of these products in the same places that regular other traditional tobacco products can't be used. And then we also created a requirement for warning signs to be posted in retailers' establishments so that they actually put up signs that indicate that e-cigarettes, tobacco products are hazardous to health. The tobacco industry spends billions of dollars to market their products, and though they may claim that they're not marketing them toward youth, some of these products, you don't create products that are candy-flavored, mint, creme brulee-flavored to appeal to adults. That's really meant to be appealing to youth. We don't have those kinds of budgets in the public sector, and so what we've done is we've required that retailers in the city of Chicago put up warning signs that really make it clear that these products are addictive and harmful to health.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Julie Morita, commissioner for the Chicago Department of Public Health, and Chicago back in 2016 raised the purchasing age for tobacco to 21, and this hour we're talking about the fact that a lot of states are following suit as well. Dr. Morita, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Let's go straight to the phones. Matthew is calling from Richmond, Virginia. Matthew, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to express just a comment here. I wanted you all to speak just briefly on kind of how this affects raising the minimum age to 21 for tobacco products, because we passed a similar law here in Virginia just recently. I kind of wanted you to briefly discuss how it affects public health as a whole on the long term as well, because many of the discussions I have with my friends about this, they say, well, we're adults, we can make this choice, but they don't really understand how this benefits society as a whole long term. And I know that's a pretty broad question, but I just wanted to express the importance of it and see what you think about it.
Yeah, Matthew, don't hang up yet. So you say when you have discussions with your friends, do they use e-cigarettes? Do you?
Yes, I do. Rest assured, making plans to quit. However, I do have friends who use tobacco products, e-cigarettes, cigarettes themselves, and some of them will argue, well, we can go into the military, we can do the lottery, we can do all the things an adult can do, but we can't buy tobacco products if you're under 21. And I try to express to them the health benefits, but, you know, some people prefer their choice instead.
Yeah. Okay. Matthew from Richmond, Virginia, thank you so much for your call. So let's get an answer to Matthew's question about how does it affect the public health at large. Joining us now is Dr. Suzanne Tansky. She is a professor of pediatrics at Dartmouth College. She's a tobacco control expert with more than 17 years of experience researching tobacco issues and products and counseling youth who use those products. She's also the former chair of the American Association of Pediatrics Tobacco Consortium. Dr. Tansky, welcome to On Point.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me, Meghna.
So we had that great call asking sort of a big picture question about how does raising the tobacco age or purchasing age to 21, how does it affect the public health overall?
Well, that's a really important issue. So cigarettes are a defective product that, used as intended, will kill half of the people who are long-term users. So from a public health standpoint, stopping people from using tobacco and helping them to quit cigarettes is one of the best things we can do. We're going to lose 440,000 people in the United States this year to tobacco-related deaths. So yes, adults can make their own decisions, but this is a product that would never have seen the light of day if we put product restrictions on cigarettes back in the 1900s when cigarettes were created. This is really a defective product, and really it's not safe for anybody to use.
And so does that same logic, though, apply for e-cigarettes and for vaping?
It's an interesting question. So cigarettes, again, if cigarettes are our comparison, killing half of their long-term users, I don't really like that comparison. I really prefer the comparison to be healthy air. And if we're comparing e-cigarettes to combusted tobacco cigarettes, they really are quite different. There are fewer things that are in e-cigarettes, but they are not without harm. And there is equal or higher amounts of nicotine in the various products. The products are really different from each other, and we'll get into that in a moment if we have time. So I can't say that one vape is another. But we have not gotten away from the ultrafine particles and some of the other byproducts that happen when you heat up the vape that is in them to high temperatures. Things break down. You have a different characteristic based on flavors, based on the nicotine, and based on the stuff that makes the vapor, what's called the humectant. And those things, when they break down, have harmful characteristics all by themselves.
So, Dr. Tansky, stand by here for a moment, because I do want to explore with you more when we come back from a break about exactly what's in an e-cigarette versus a regular cigarette and the effects, especially that might have on the teenage brain. So we're talking about the fact that more cities and states are trying to raise tobacco purchasing ages to 21 in order to curb e-cigarette use amongst teens. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about the increasing number of cities and states who are raising their tobacco purchasing age to 21, in part to curb the rate of teen vaping in those cities and states. Want to know what you think about teens and e-cigarettes and whether or not you're experiencing that in your own life, if you have a teen who vapes or if you do it yourself, and if you think raising the tobacco purchasing age to 21 is going to make a difference in the rising number of teens who are trying out e-cigarettes. And let's listen to an ad from the FDA, FDA's anti-vaping campaign that launched just last fall on YouTube and other social media channels, you know, meeting teens where they are. The ads depict nicotine spreading through teenagers' bodies and disfiguring their faces.
There's an epidemic spreading. Scientists say it can change your brain. It can release dangerous chemicals like formaldehyde into your bloodstream. It can expose your lungs to acrolein, which can cause irreversible damage. It's not a parasite, not a virus, not an infection. It's vaping.
An anti-vaping ad from the FDA. Well, how do these ads fall on teen ears? Morgan Radford of NBC's Today Show spoke with a group of high school seniors last fall about why vaping appeals to them and to their classmates.
You come for the coolness, but you stay for the buzz.
I think a big thing is the fact that it's just not a cigarette. You know, we're taught from a really young age about, like, not smoking cigarettes and the damage of cigarettes and stuff like that.
That's from the NBC Today show, some teens talking to Morgan Radford. We're joined today by Dr. Suzanne Tansky. She's a professor of pediatrics at Dartmouth College and former chair of the American Association of Pediatrics Tobacco Consortium. Okay, Dr. Tansky, I would really love for you to take us a little further into exactly sort of what's in an e-cigarette. And you said before the break that they're all a little different. But, you know, what effect does it have on teenage brains?
So we're going to start nerding out with a little bit of science, and we're going to use the analogy of light bulbs. So your night light is 4 watts. The light bulbs that are above your bathroom are 60 watts. And when you're reading, it's probably 100 or 150 watts. We have that same kind of array of strengths, of wattage of power with e-cigarettes as well. And the power plus the nicotine concentration is where you get your nicotine delivery. So all e-cigarettes or all vaping devices are not the same. So if we talk about Juul, which was mentioned earlier, that's a fairly low watt device, 7 or 8 watts, but it's very high nicotine concentration, around 50 milligrams per milliliter. So it's a high nicotine delivery system with relatively low power.
Well, can I just jump in here? Because Juul itself says that one of their vaping pods could have as much nicotine as an entire pack of cigarettes.
That's correct. And I have patients and young people who are vaping a whole pod a day. And I point out, hey, you know, that's like a whole pack of cigarettes. And they're shocked. They really don't appreciate how much nicotine they're actually getting. And Juul is designed for rapid hit of nicotine to your brain. It's been characterized and developed so that it really mimics a combusted tobacco cigarette, which is what really gets the nicotine levels highest in your brain. So these are the highest nicotine addiction potential. These are they hit your brain. They give you that buzz, as you heard from the student from the NBC show. So that's what the kids are really seeing, and that's what they like, and that's what makes them feel good, is that little bit of a buzz. Nicotine is a drug that does not make you high. You don't lose your sense of perception. It just gives you that little lift and that little buzz, and so it's pleasant. And what the problem with that is that it becomes you develop dependence, and that leads to addiction. And you need that drug in your blood and in your brain in order to feel well. And you feel really poor when you don't have that on board.
Right.
And so it's this vicious cycle that you need it, otherwise you don't feel good.
Well, can I just jump in here for a second?
Yeah, please, please.
So is the fall off also relatively quick? Because there's all these anecdotal stories now that we're hearing about some teens who are very heavy e-cigarette users, like needing to have a hit from their Juul every half an hour.
Right. And again, the characteristics are different. Everyone's metabolism is a little bit different. And the way people vape is different. So we've talked about Juul as one product, but then there's other products like the Cigalikes, the kind of disposables or the rechargeables. They have lower power. They have lower delivery. And so those have kind of really a lower addiction potential because they don't carry that same kind of a buzz. And with people who are using those modifiable ones where they can change the wattage so they can tune it down so it's more like your night light, or they can crank it way up so it's like your task lighting. And that changes the nicotine delivery, and that changes the characteristics of how it works in your brain and in your body. So I can't say that any individual, I can't compare three people and say you're going to need more than another one and you're going to need another hit in 15 minutes or 3 hours, because everyone is a little bit different. And that's really why this is a tough thing to tackle, because if you tell me you smoke a cigarette, I have a pretty good idea of how much nicotine you're getting. But with these other devices, we need to know a lot more in order to know, how do we treat you? How do we approach you? How do we help you become a non-nicotine user? And we're really stuck because there haven't been any studies yet.
Yeah. So, Dr. Tansky, though, let me ask you here. Is nicotine, regarding teens, is
yes.
nicotine addiction the primary concern here? Because Juul and other e-cigarette companies would say and do say that for adult smokers, e-cigarettes are a healthier option because of they lack all the other compounds and chemicals that come with smoking regular cigarettes. Because, you know, you heard in that clip before, the other thing that the teen said to NBC was, I think the big thing is that it's just not a cigarette. We're taught from a young age to not smoke cigarettes and the damage cigarettes do and stuff like that, with the implication there that the teens are saying they don't believe that e-cigarettes do them any damage.
And that's a big problem we're having. So it took 20 to 40 years for us to really figure out what harms come from combusted tobacco cigarettes. So back in the 1900s, before the automatic cigarette rolling machines were created, people didn't smoke cigarettes. And it was only once those they became very mainstream and very popular that cigarettes took off. And you saw this mirror of lung cancer about 20 to 30 years later that really mimicked the curve that you saw with people smoking additional cigarettes. And so it takes a long time for some of these harms to happen in our bodies. And yes, there are not all of the constituents that are present in cigarettes, but there's a lot of things in there that are of concern. In particular, we know that there are metals that can come off of the coils. That's not healthy to breathe into your lungs. Our bodies were not evolved to metabolize propylene glycol or glycerin in our lungs. That's not how our lungs work. And many of the some of the other things that are in vapes are ultrafine particles. And in many of the products that they've looked at, the amount of ultrafine particles that are in electronic cigarette vapor are the same as in combusted tobacco cigarettes. You can't see these ultrafine particles. You can see smoke. You can see aerosol. Mm. But these are things that are even smaller and can cross your lung tissue directly and go into your bloodstream and cause inflammation. And we think that the inflammation is really what's driving heart attacks and strokes. And so we may not be any better off from a heart attack and stroke standpoint by people using vape as compared to combusted tobacco cigarettes. And that would be really harmful.
Okay, so Dr. Tansky, you can imagine we have a lot of callers
yes.
who want to join us. So let me just bring a couple of them in here. Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. My son vapes, and he vapes right in front of us. So I think he really has no concept of the fact that it's bad or that it's harmful to your health or that it's like cigarettes. Thanks.
Well, Jim, don't go away just yet. How do you feel that he does it right in front of you?
I guess he's 21. He's an adult. Mm. I think he's going to do it regardless of what we say.
And so, I mean, does it...
It's but, a difficult situation.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, but you know your son maybe better than he knows himself. I mean, in the past, what does it take to change his behavior when he was doing stuff that maybe you didn't think was good for him?
He's been doing it for 2 to 3 years without us knowing about it. And now that he's older, I just think we don't really have the ability to change his behavior now that he's older.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Jim, thank you so much for your call. Let's hear from Aslan, who's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. I love your show, and the show today hits so personal. My wife and I, we switched over from cigarettes to Juul about 4 years ago. And it was honestly the best thing we did because, you know, they are right. There is much less product in Juul than regular cigarettes. And health-wise, we feel so much better. But it's so annoying every time I reach for it. I mean, it is, I think, a little more addictive than cigarettes. Just trying to quit both. It's much harder to quit Juul, I feel like. But I think what we need to do is to make it uncool. Mm. You know, what I hate about it is not the health, but the financial, you know, drawbacks from it. We spend about $350 a month for Juul products. And, you know, that's $4,000, $5,000 a year we could be going towards vacations and other stuff that normal people are supposed to do. But, you know, we got to change something with the marketing. Yeah.
Yeah. Aslan, thank you so much for your call. Okay, Dr. Tansky, just respond to what Aslan said. He switched over from cigarettes thinking it would be healthier. Maybe he even feels better. But now he's spending $4,000 a year on his Juul. So how? What do we know about what it would take to end the nicotine addiction that comes through some of these e-cigarettes?
Well, first of all, let me say congratulations. I'm so glad that you were able to get off of combusted tobacco because that's a huge saver of your life already. And now the next task is going to be to see how we can get you off of Juul and off of these vaping nicotine products. And we don't have a lot of evidence as to what's the best approach because there's such variability and because we don't have a lot of studies that are really driving us towards a single answer. But we do know that nicotine replacement products, which are FDA approved, they are clean products, they do not have of any breakdown products from being heated to high temperature. There's no metal. There's no carcinogens. They are the safest form of nicotine that we know about. And so I would suggest that switching to a form of nicotine replacement therapy to try to wean yourself off of Juul would probably be a good approach, or just try cutting back on your Juul usage. It's going to be a process because these products do have high nicotine in them, and you are likely very physically as well as psychologically dependent on this product. So getting some good behavioral support is helpful. And there are a number of places. The Quit Lines will help people who are vaping. And in addition, the Truth Initiative, which is has been doing a lot of work on helping young people not take up and to quit both cigarettes and vaping products, they have an app that's called This Is Quitting. And they just released that a couple months ago, specifically focusing on vaping. And in the absence of anything else, let's give that a try for folks who are trying to quit vaping.
Yeah. Dr. Tansky, I wanted to ask you one more question about Juul specifically, because we did reach out to them and asked a representative from Juul to join us today. They declined that, but they did offer, they sent us quite a lengthy statement, and it reads in part, this is again from Juul: "We strongly support raising the purchasing age for all tobacco products, including vapor products, to 21, and have been actively supporting legislation to do this in states across the country and at the federal level." The Juul statement goes on to say, "We cannot fulfill our mission to provide the world's 1 billion adult smokers with a true alternative to combustible cigarettes, the number one cause of preventable death in this country, if youth use continues unabated." And then they talk again about how they support tobacco 21 laws. So about that, those adult smokers there, I mean, this, even from within the public health community, this is where some of the pushback comes, that they say we shouldn't be making it harder to get access or buy e-cigarette products, because they are helping a lot of adult smokers who maybe want to move towards quitting. Does raising the tobacco age to 21 have an impact on that? If you've got, I don't know, 19 or 20 year olds who may want to use e-cigarettes to quit the youth smoking that they started at younger ages?
Well, we know that Tobacco 21 is very effective. So I think when you were talking with Dr. Morita, I don't know if she used the statistic, but the number of initiators for cigarettes in Chicago decreased by 36% over 2016 to 2017. This works. And where it really works is in the 15 to 17-year-olds. If you get tobacco products and vaping products out of the high schools, kids don't initiate. The high school kids aren't hanging out with 21-year-olds, but they are hanging out with 18-year-olds. And anecdotally, I have an 18-year-old son, and on his 18th birthday, his friends called and said, "Will you buy me Juul?" Thankfully, he said no. He knows what I do. But this is a real problem. We do need to try to keep it out of the high schools. The number of cigarettes that are purchased by 20-year-olds is about 1% of the total cigarettes in the United States. So it's a fraction of cigarettes that are sold to this population. If we keep it out of their hands, that will have a great impact on both initiation and cessation. If they can't get the products, they're not likely to use them. And with all cases where there've been a Tobacco 21 sales restriction, that's been effective. So some have not included vaping, but again, if we're preventing both cigarettes and vapes, we'll be getting closer to keeping kids from having them.
But isn't alcohol consumption the most obvious example of why it doesn't really matter what a legal age is? That if kids want to do it, if teens want to do it, they're going to get their hands on it.
They will, but every barrier we put in place, as Dr. Morita was saying, price matters, so taxation matters a whole lot. Kids are very sensitive to pricing structure, so if we make it more expensive, they're less likely to use it. If you make it harder for them to get it at a store, at a convenience store, at a gas station, they're less likely to use it. These barriers actually make a big difference in uptake, and so every single step we can take is going to help. And as was mentioned earlier, and I think we'll talk about next, changing the advertising also matters, making this not cool. We've done a great job changing the social norm around cigarettes, and we need to now change the social norm around vaping and make it not cool so that these young people don't think that it's the next best thing, because all we're doing is creating a new generation of people who are dependent on nicotine, and teens who are dependent on nicotine become adults who are dependent on nicotine, and we need to break that cycle.
Well, we will... We got to take a break in a couple of minutes. And when we come back from that break, we will talk about the advertising around it. But we've got some comments here coming in online. Jason Glaspie says it'll be as effective as all prohibition throughout history has been. Jason implying that it will not be effective at all. Let's see, what else do we see here? Frank Barton says, yes, teen smoking and vaping is a problem. So is any smoking or vaping? Why are tobacco products still sold at all? And this interesting comment from Jamie Bensler, who says, does treating young adults more like children lead them to make more childish decisions? Dr. Chansky, what do you think about that one?
I'm a pediatrician. I love kids. They're my population that I love the most. So I don't think that's true. And really, the adolescent brain is uniquely susceptible to nicotine addiction. So if we prevent and protect an adolescent brain from nicotine exposure until that brain is well into its 20s, it's less likely to have a lifetime addiction. So this isn't a child thing. This is a developmental brain structure issue. And so really protecting those brains is better. And to the point of alcohol, we're seeing a lot fewer alcohol-related traffic incidents once we raise the alcohol age to 21. That's undeniable.
Well, Dr. Susan Tansky, professor of pediatrics at Dartmouth College, stand by for just a second. We are talking about an increasing number of cities and states raising their tobacco purchasing age to 21 in order to curb teen vaping rates. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie. And I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the fact that more cities and now states are raising their tobacco purchasing ages to 21, in part to curb teen vaping rates and teen e-cigarette smoking rates. I'm joined this hour by Dr. Susan Tansky. She's a professor of pediatrics at Dartmouth College and a former chair of the American Association of Pediatrics Tobacco Consortium. Got a lot of comments coming in online here. M. DelVecchio says, my friend was a smoker and used vaping to dial down his nicotine delivery until it was next to nothing. Then he stopped altogether, thus vaping helped him quit smoking. USA Celt says, why are there no vaping advocates on? Well, USA Celt, we did ask Juul. They are the dominant company in this market right now to join us, and they declined but offered a statement. Again, I'll just read a part of it, saying that they strongly support Tobacco 21 initiatives in states and also at the federal level. But again, Juul declined. However, let's go to Ed, who's calling from Ithaca, New York. Ed, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I smoked for 15, almost 20 years, pack and a half a day, my wife as well. We both switched to vaping. And it's helped my life tremendously. And I just want to point to the Royal College of Physicians, who say that e-cigarettes are a safer alternative by almost 98% to smoking combustible tobacco. And I agree that we should do something about the age. Underage vaping is a problem. But to villainize vaping and to ban flavors, I don't think is the right way. I think as a vaping community, all the advertising, the, you know, cartoon-like logos and, you know, advertising something as specifically candied flavored is a problem, and we could do more. But I think the FDA needs to work more with the vaping community so that we can come up with better guidelines for how these things should be marketed rather than to just villainize the entire community.
Well, Ed, thank you so much for your call. So let me bring Ryan Kennedy into the conversation now. Ryan joins us from Baltimore, Maryland. He's a professor of public health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. His research focuses on tobacco control in the U.S. and internationally, including health warnings, cessation supports, and advertising as well. So Professor Ryan Kennedy, welcome to you.
Hello, Magna.
Okay, so you just heard our caller there saying that he thinks the vaping community overall is getting a bad rap now and that there are better ways of working with the community to take serious efforts on curbing teen e-cigarette usage rates. What do you think about that?
No, it's always been a hard path to walk here. We are getting more and more evidence to suggest that e-cigarettes or other vaping devices are helpful for some people to transition away from combustibles. Of course, we want the evidence that they can transition completely, not remain what we call a dual user, so dialing down a little bit of your smoking but still smoking several cigarettes a day. As the devices have become more mature, more sophisticated, they seem to be doing a better job. The ability for a device like Juul to deliver nicotine to an adult smoker, like we heard earlier, the nicotine blood concentration can mirror or even exceed that of a cigarette with an experienced user. So we have this device that seems to hold promise. It's certainly not safe. It's not something that a naive nicotine user should initiate on, but we're really challenged in how we message very clearly to young people just the relative danger of these devices. We had the analogy earlier of the light bulbs, the 4-watt, the 60-watt. It's almost like that with tobacco products as well. When we measure by constituent, there are different levels of risk. Mm. E-cigarettes are not risk-free. They're quite dangerous. And like Dr. Tansky was saying, there's probably things we just don't know about the health effects given the longevity of the disease manifestation.
Right. So help us understand then this core question. I mean, we're looking at the raising of the tobacco purchasing age to 21 and whether or not that's effective in curbing teen e-cigarette usage. But we do have a generation of advertising surrounding reducing teen cigarette or tobacco use more broadly. So that there's a great amount of data here that we can look to figure out what works. So what does work in changing teen behavior regarding smoking or tobacco?
Sure. So the what we've learned from public health is that we typically need a very comprehensive approach. We need to be using all the tools that are available to us, and that includes things like restricting marketing. That includes things like ages purchase. It includes taxes. It includes things like product regulation. We probably should require any e-cigarette manufacturer to allow consumers to purchase products that have different levels of nicotine, different concentrations, to help those, that couple that we heard that switched, but now they want to get off. How do we do that? There's probably a role in terms of how we design these products as well. Juul has been a really interesting rise for us to watch in public health. And as a product, there are aspects of its design that are just so appealing to young people. Mm-hmm. It's small. Kids can hide them in their hand. They're easy to share. They don't make a mess. It's not like a cigarette where you have ash and things like that that kids would have to contend with. We can probably use levers to require specific design considerations to make them, and to quote one of the callers, less cool.
And so, but then you'd have to ask Juul to change a core aspect of their product. I mean, that seems to be, a lot of people would see that as government overreach.
It might be, or if they're being consistent with that, what they say and that they're trying to target to adults, an adult that's really motivated to quit using combustibles should be motivated to try a product that's going to work, not one that's going to be, indigo blue.
Mm. Well, I want to talk more specifically. I mean, so that's the design itself, the industrial design of a Juul pod to begin with. But I want to explore advertising a little more here, because
sure,
one of the things that people talk about is how, even though companies like Juul say they are not directly advertising through social media to teens, nevertheless, there's a lot of, I guess, I don't want to say celebration, but e-cigarette usage in social media. So how does that is there a place there to curb its appeal to teenagers?
Right. The marketing field has expanded with the expansion of social media. And we're now facing sort of quandaries about how to begin to regulate some of this content in similar ways. What we've witnessed with Juul's and other e-cigarette manufacturers is a real mastery of the use of internet sort of the people that influence others. Mm-hmm. They're actually called internet influencers. So if you're an individual on Instagram and you have 100,000 followers, companies could pay you to promote their product, to use their product, to post pictures of your product. And what we've seen happen is this incredible boom of sort of a hashtag promotion of products where influencers might be the first out of the gate to introduce their followers to a product or product features. And then users and other even young people on the internet will pick up and create their own hashtags and, in a sense, do all the marketing for a company, keying into sort of basic branding principles.
Mm-hmm. Well, sorry, Ryan, forgive me for interrupting there, but on this point about marketing, I just want to go to a caller really quickly. John is calling from Baltimore, Maryland. John, you're on the air. Do you see a lot of ads or marketing for e-cigarettes or vaping?
Hey, thanks for having me. Actually, he pretty much nailed it. Even when I was a lot younger, when I was like 18, I have not seen a single ad for vaping. Everything that I see is my friends that are vaping next to me, or stuff on social media where people are blowing like huge clouds, and that looks impressive, and I think that makes people want to vape more.
So do you think that, if we want to curb teenage e-cigarette uses, that we ought to focus on social media, or are there other places that you would look?
I mean, I think you should focus on social media. People need to focus on how cool it looks. And the other thing I think is extremely important is the vape shops that are selling them to underage people, you know, that aren't carding and just giving it to, you know, whoever goes in there.
Yeah. Well, John, thank you so much for your call. Dr. Chansky, this has come up a couple of times that it looks cool, right? Ryan Kennedy was just saying even the design of a Juul itself looks cool. That's exactly the same thing that people used to say about cigarette smoking, right? It was it looked cool, like movie stars were doing it here. So how did we change that to message that maybe it might look cool, but it isn't cool to do?
Sure. And actually, if you look at some of the vaping advertising that's been out, they really took some lessons directly from Big Tobacco's playbook. And you look back and you can see really mirrors of old ads from the 50s and 60s kind of coming up again with some vaping ads. And I'm surprised that the previous caller said he hasn't seen ads, because I've definitely seen them. They've been on the Super Bowl. So there are ads that are now on television. Tobacco ads have been banned from TV since 1970. And now there are vaping ads. So there are vaping ads out there. They're in magazines. They're in print. They are all over social media. It's difficult to tell if something is a social influencer that's been paid by an industry, or is this just word of mouth? And you really can't tell the difference between those. So I completely agree. It's important for us to make these less cool. And it is going to take some peer influencers to change that conversation, either in the high school or in colleges, just where the young people are, making this less attractive.
Well, I want to play an anti-smoking ad, cigarette smoking ad for television made by the CDC. This is from 2012, and you're going to hear someone named Terry offering tips on getting ready in the morning after Terry had throat cancer, which caused her to have a laryngectomy and lose her teeth and her hair.
I'm Terry, and I used to be a smoker. I want to give you some tips about getting ready in the morning. Lord, you're there. Then your head will divide. And now you're ready for the night.
2012 anti-smoking television ad from the CDC. Ryan Kennedy, do ads like that work for teens? I mean, that one's kind of one, I guess, designed to scare you about the effects of cigarette smoking. Do teens get that message, or are there better ways to reach them?
What we've learned in public health messaging is basically what works for an adult will work for a teen. Sometimes when we get too segmented, we really run the risk of speaking down to the audience. Teens like to consider themselves as very sophisticated. I think something like that with Terry, obviously in marketing, different messages are going to appeal to different people at different times. But her series of PSAs were super powerful and very personal, and she was very brave. And I think regardless of your age, you can appreciate that.
Mm. By the way, Dr. Tansky, actually, I'm going to take a slight tangent here because we're getting a lot of questions about secondhand smoke and vaping mm-hmm. and e-cigarettes. Is that an issue?
It is, but it's difficult to measure because, again, the changes, the difference in the product characteristics. There are some vapes, as actually Ryan was just mentioning, where you have a huge – actually, the guest was saying there's these huge plumes and there's a tremendous amount of aerosol that comes off of them. And when you have some of those large plumes with lots of aerosol, they do deposit more kind of particulates into a space. And in vaping competitions and in various locations, they've tested the air quality. And vape can make the air quality harmful, and it violates the kind of public health standards for air quality. So yes, it does introduce particulates into a space. Depending on the product, it may not actually release as much nicotine as a traditional combusted tobacco cigarette. But we do know that the vape that comes off can actually trigger asthma. It can trigger respiratory complaints. So it's not benign by itself.
Mm. Ryan Kennedy here. Someone a little earlier sent us a message on Facebook. Chris Tucker says, the real story, the actual story, is that Altria owns 35% of Juul. Now, Altria is a huge company, and I believe at the end of last year, they bought this 35% stake in Juul for $12.8 billion in December. And just for folks who may not know of Altria, they actually also own, for example, they have a major stake in Anheuser-Busch and Philip Morris as well here. So how much of the story is that these huge companies are moving into the e-cigarette space, if I could use that phrase?
I think it's exactly the story. We need to understand that every major closed system e-cigarette on the market today is owned by a major tobacco company, JTI, Altria, British American Tobacco. They each have either developed or purchased e-cigarettes businesses. And the witnessed what we're seeing in terms of the marketing strategies, the positioning, it's right out of their playbooks from decades ago. This is really concerning. The stake in Juul from Altria, that kind of an investment sets up Juul very well to take their product globally.
Dr. Tansky, what do you think about that?
Ryan's dead on. This is really concerning. And there are some different laws that are present around the globe for kind of concentration of nicotine. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens as time goes on and how Juul and some of these other products will change their characteristics so that they can abide by the laws in each of these countries where they probably want to expand their market share. So to the point that they can change their products, I'm sure they will change their products to change the market and get a global footprint. Mm.
Well, Ryan Kennedy, we've got a minute left to go here, and I want to circle back to where we started about this idea of raising the purchasing age for tobacco products to 21. I mean, given how popular it seems e-cigarettes are or increasingly becoming amongst teens, do you think it's an effective step or just a first step?
I think it's an important step. I think the meme that my kids shared with me this morning was, why are there toilets in the Juul room? I think we need to do what we can to get these products out of the schools. The access to products from older kids is a known pathway. If kids don't have those products, if we don't have the social norms created in those important settings for young people, we won't have people addicted to nicotine.
Well, Ryan Kennedy is a professor of public health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health with us today from Baltimore. Professor Ryan Kennedy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Dr. Susan Tansky, professor of pediatrics at Dartmouth College and former chair of the American Association of Pediatrics Tobacco Consortium. Dr. Tansky, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Folks, you can always continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Also, follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Our program is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, and Alex Schroeder, with help from Matt Hoisch, Alex Pena, and Cindy Wertheim. Sydney. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.
Support for On Point comes from College Vine. Using data to provide personalized college guidance, admissions advisors help high school students apply to college based on their chances of getting accepted and receiving scholarship awards. More at collegevine.com. And Fracture, creating frameless photo decor and gifts by printing digital photos directly on glass. A Fracture is image and mount in one, available in a selection of ready-to-display sizes. Learn more at fractureme.com/onpoint.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on the next On Point, President Trump wants his allies Stephen Moore and Herman Cain to join the Federal Reserve. Are politics and monetary policy on a collision course? Plus, public intellectual Irshad Manji has a provocative suggestion for her fellow progressives. To heal American divides, she says, stop shaming and start listening. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.